Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Cynthia Miyashita, Chair of the Club's Asia Pacific Affairs Forum and your chair for today's program. Haiku across borders, from Japan to the United States and back again, perspectives of an American haiku poet with Abigail Friedman. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. Today's program is in association with the Consulate General of Japan in San Francisco. It's also part of our Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'd also like to thank the Japan Society of Northern California for being a community sponsor of today's program. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Abigail Friedman is an award-winning haiku poet and former U.S. diplomat who lived in Japan for 8 years, first in Hiroshima for 2 years, and later in Tokyo. She began composing haiku in 2001 as the only non-Japanese member of a haiku group that met near Mount Fuji, an experience she captures in her book, The Haiku Apprentice, Memoirs of Writing Poetry in Japan. In her second book on haiku, I Wait for the Moon, 100 Haiku of Momoko Kuroda, Ms. Friedman has translated and provides commentary to the haiku of one of Japan's most well-known contemporary poets. She's won numerous awards for her haiku, including first prize in the 2014 Mainichi Shimbun International Haiku Contest. She's a member of the Haiku Society of America and Haiku Canada, and founder of Quebec City's first French-English bilingual haiku group. Her haiku, haibun, and writings on haiku have been featured in poetry publications in the U.S., India, Japan, Canada, and France. Ms. Friedman is on the board of trustees of the Japan-America Society of Washington, D.C., and is the founder and CEO of the Wisteria Group, an international advisory firm that helps businesses and nonprofits create new strategic partnerships, including in the cultural arena. Would you please join me in welcoming Ms. Friedman to the club to share with us her perspective on haiku across borders.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I want to thank the Commonwealth Club and the Japanese Consulate General of San Francisco. It's quite an honor to be here. What we will do today is I'm going to talk probably about for 45 minutes, a little bit about haiku in Japan, maybe a lot about haiku in Japan. Then we'll look at haiku in English composed by American composers, and then I will wrap it up talking a little bit about the relationship of the two. So let me start by talking a bit about how I got involved with haiku. And also, we'll start with the end here. The two books that I wrote on haiku that I will be referring to are at the back, and you're welcome to pick them up. Here we go. So The Haiku Apprentice talks about my experience learning about haiku in Japan, and I Wait for the Moon are translations of my haiku teacher's poems. When I first learned about haiku, I learned about it in Japan. I really didn't know much about haiku. I have to be honest, the reason I started reading haiku was because I had a pretty busy job at the American Embassy, and I had 3 children, and I desperately wanted to improve my Japanese. And I thought if I just read 1 haiku poem a night, it was short enough that I would feel that I accomplished something before I fell asleep. So that's what was the attraction for me initially in reading haiku. So I would read a lot of haiku. And one day I was giving a talk on actually North Korea issues in Japan. I don't know. Many of you, I'm sure, have either been to Japan or have some exposure to Japan. One of the things that's very common is after you give a talk, you do what's called an aisatsu, a little introduction about yourself. So it was the aisatsu time, and I had to think of something interesting that I did with myself. So when it was my turn, I said that I like to read Japanese haiku in the evening. After this, a man came up to me from the audience and said, well, you should join my haiku group. And I had never heard of a haiku group. I didn't know what it was about. But I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. I like new things, and I was curious about Japan and Japanese culture. So when his invitation came, I decided to go. And off I went to Numazu, which is about 2 hours outside of Tokyo, to this beautiful place where people were gathered to write haiku. And this is a picture of our Numamomo haiku group. I apologize, it's not a great photo, but it was the only one that I had. You'll notice that I'm the only Japanese person, American person in this Japanese group. So it was a bit of a struggle. People were very warm, but I had to write haiku in Japanese if I wanted to come back and continue with this wonderful exotic experience. The other thing that was interesting about this group is that the person who led the group is someone named Momoko Kuroda. I had never heard of her. It turns out much later I discovered she was a very well-known contemporary Japanese haiku poet. What I had noticed was the amazing clothes she wore. And she dresses like that, like all the time. It's just really impressive. A previous time when I gave this talk, someone immediately asked me all about the deer and what the deer symbolized. So I just want to answer that question now. This picture was taken in Miyajima, I think, which is outside of Hiroshima. Miyajima is famous for the tori there, that red thing in the back. But also, there are a lot of deer on the island. So that was the composition. So I asked her, I was starting to write haiku, and I would show up at my haiku group, but I realized I needed to learn a lot more. So I asked her if she would give me additional private lessons in haiku. One of the things that's amazing about Momoko is her open-mindedness. You know, here was a famous haiku poet. As I said, I didn't know that she was famous. And she said, sure. I think she just saw an opportunity that this would be interesting not only for me but for her to sort of get a sense of how does this American process haiku. It was not, I didn't pay her, that wasn't what the relationship was about, but it was a shared learning experience. When I started with haiku, I had these questions. And these are questions that I still have today and that most people still have. I'm not going to give you the answer in a quick sentence at the end. But that's what I was kind of groping with. And Momoko started with the basics. And she said, like most people you will hear in Japan, if you ask them what a haiku is, it's 17 sounds, a season word or kigo, and a kireji or cut word. I'm just going to mention briefly what these are, and then I'm happy to go into this later in the Q&A. But the 5-7-5 formula that many of us have heard of are sounds, and sounds are not the same as syllables. The sounds in Japanese are all about the same beat, the same length. So when you say five sounds, it's going like that. Syllables in English are very varied in length. So the word is one syllable, and the word large is one syllable. But the beat that they have are very different, which is, point number one, that making a direct comparison of Japanese sounds and American syllables is not exactly apt. Season word is basically a word that will root the poem in a season. Obvious words are, summer or cold for winter. But there are other things that are a little less obvious, and we will get back to season words in a little bit. A kireji or a cut word is not a word with meaning, but there are very specific cut words like ya, keri, kana. I think of it as in a song in English we might have, she loves me, yeah, yeah, yeah. That yeah, yeah, yeah serves as a cut in some ways. It creates a space, a pause, a cut in it. So So this is great. I'm learning and I'm taking notes. And of course, I'll start with the basic one that everyone in Japan and probably most people who know anything or have shown any interest in haiku in English have heard as well. And this one, as you'll see, it's 5-7-5. I'm not going to spend too much time breaking them up, but let's just try for the first one. Fu is one sound, ru is one sound, I is a sound, ke is a sound, ya is a sound. So that's the first five, furu, ike, ya. Ya is the cut word. Frogs are the season word for spring. Basho wrote this one. I had a little fun translating this one because I put the word frogs in. Just most of you may have heard it, a frog jumps in the water, but since in Japanese you can't tell whether it was a frog or frogs, I just threw in frogs for this time. Here's another famous one. Again, it's 5-7-5. It has a season word, persimmon, and it has a cut word, nari. Shiki, as many of you know, Basho is seen as the father of haiku. Shiki came along in the late 19th century and really revived haiku and sort of modernized it. Through his writings, his messaging, his basic point was to, one of his basic points was really people in Japan don't have to be writing haiku the way Basho did with Basho's themes. Write haiku about things that you are experiencing around you. The sketch of life concept is what he was most famous for. Another little footnote that's interesting about this one is that Horyuji Temple, he actually was not at Horyuji Temple when he wrote this one. He was at Todaiji Temple. But after he wrote it, he went to Horyuji the next day and decided that Horyuji would be a better temple for this haiku because Horyuji is famous for its persimmon, among other reasons. And I mention that because often people who are writing haiku in English feel that haiku has to be a completely accurate description of an experience. Whereas in Japan, it has always been an art, and the aesthetic sense is important in a haiku. Here's another one. Traditional form. It's 5-7-5. Summer grasses is the season word, and it's got a cut somewhere in there, ni, I think. The reason I wanted to show you this one is because one of the things that I learned from my haiku teacher is that season words are not just to tell you what season something is in, but they also link a poem to other poems that have been written with that same season word. So when I looked at this one, it made me think of this one, which is another famous one by Basho. So it gives you this sense of, it's part of the depth of a haiku. It's not just that individual haiku, but it's sort of this echo of what other people have written. Seishi's, see if we go back here. What's interesting about the Seishi haiku is that he's brought in a locomotive. You know, he wrote this in, I think 1933. So, you know, he's putting trains in his haiku. Basho is making references to past battles, famous battles and wars. Another thing I wanted to mention about season words is, I may be anticipating a little, but actually I'm not going to mention it. I'll get to this later. Let's just keep going. Here's another one by Hashimoto Mudo. Mitsumame is the season word. Mitsumame are those jelly things, and I have a feeling probably a lot of people in California know what they are. When I give this talk on the East Coast, there's not as many people who are exposed to Japanese foods and culture. what's, again, it's 575. It has a season word. One of the fun things about this haiku is that thematically, Mudo is connecting his work not to past historic Japanese things, but Greek gods. So there's sort of an international resonance or concept that's interesting. And here's one last one. This one is by Momoko, and it's in my book. One of the things that when I was translating, one of the challenges of translating, it's not just getting the word right, but it's helping people understand the concept as it as a poem might be digested by a Japanese audience. And fireflies are interesting to me because in Japan, a firefly represents many things, but one of the things it also represents is the spirit of the dead, which is not something that I thought of at all when I looked at a poem with fireflies in it. But if we think of the fireflies as somehow symbolizing or being the spirits of people who are no longer here, then the poem has another kind of connection, because this we picture an older woman out in the countryside in Japan, where there are not a lot of, many people have moved to Tokyo. It's a depopulated area, and the people she is with now are the spirits of people, the fireflies. That's just one interpretation. One of the things that that Momoko always, when I first started translating her haiku, I went back to her and I said, okay, what does this haiku mean, like the fireflies one? And she would say, oh, I wrote that one when I was in Tochigi Prefecture. And I would think, okay, maybe she didn't understand my question. And I would ask again, well, what does it mean? And she would say, oh, you know, there was a grandmother in there. So it took me a while to realize that she didn't really want to. Her interest in my translating these haiku is how I saw it and how I interpreted it. And the reader's interpretation of a haiku is valid. I think that's a key point. That and to this day, when I write haiku, whether it's in Japanese or more and more, frankly, I'm in the U.S. now, I write in English, the interesting thing is not how what I've expressed, but what other people see in it. So I thought, okay, I've got a handle on haiku. It's 575. It's got a season word. It's got a cut word, and most often, and things are humming along. I'm doing well learning haiku. And one day I was in Tokyo. I was driving the car, and I come to a stoplight, and a bus pulls up next to me. On the side of the bus is this. And I'm waiting for the light, and I start counting it, and I think, huh, that's 575. I wonder if that's a haiku technically, you know? So I go back to my office. I'm working at the embassy, and I ask all of my Japanese colleagues there, I say, so, is this a haiku? And they look at me, and they say, no, it's not a haiku. It's an advertisement on the side of a bus. And I said, yeah, but it's 575. And so they scratch their head, and one woman says, yeah, but it doesn't have a season word. And I thought, well, okay. But I was starting to get a little puzzled, because I thought things that were 575 were, that was the definition of a haiku. So I thought, okay, maybe she's right. It needs to have a season word. But then I started reading more Japanese haiku. And here's a haiku by Kaneko Tota, who is probably the most well-known contemporary poet living today. I think, what is he? He's probably 94 or something. I can't add anymore. 96. We would think that carp is the season word, but it isn't. Because season words aren't just words about nature or even words that you might think are associated with a certain season. They have to be in a season word compendium called a saijiki. And if it's not in the saijiki, it's not a season word, which is, again, very different. In America, we tend to think of a seasonal word as something that is clearly related to the season. But in Japan, it really has to be in one of the encyclopedia. This one is so here's another one. And this one, okay, so sanma is a season word. Sanma is a kind of Pacific sori. It's a fall season word. The interesting thing about this is that sanma were not always season words. During the Edo period and the Meiji period, it was not a season word. So someone who had written that same poem 100 years ago, it would not have been considered to have a season word. But now it did make it into the season word compendium, so this is a poem with a season word. A little story behind this one is, so Momoko's husband is a photographer, and so he's the one in the back in the dark room. When I told, I was having dinner with Momoko and her husband one night, and I said, you know, I'm going to use this haiku, and is that okay? And it was fine. And then afterwards, her husband pulled me aside, and he said, you know, the story to this haiku is that she wrote this when she was pretty early in her haiku career, before she was very well known. But now she's really famous, so he said, I'm the one who's grilling the sanma. So here's another haiku, and this one has no season word either, and yet it is considered a haiku in Japan. Haiku in Japan that do not have season words are still called haiku. They're mukigo haiku, no season word haiku. And Hakusen is interesting because he was actually jailed. He wrote this in 1939. He was arrested the next year for sedition because his haiku were seen as inciting people against the war. So there are this issue of politics in haiku has come up in Japan as well. So I began to see that, okay, a haiku doesn't have to have a season word to be a haiku in Japan. And then I started looking at more haiku. And here's one by Basho. It's a beautiful haiku. It has a season word. But the interesting thing is that it's not 575, it's 595. And so now I'm starting to wonder, well, what's going on? I thought haiku had to have 575. And just as I had started digesting that they didn't have to have a season word, I started learning that they don't always have to be 575. This one by Momoko is in a 775 format. I think it's 775. Ayu is a kind of smelt, and she wrote this one. She's from a part of Tochigi Prefecture that is famous for the river with these smelt returning. And so, you know, she was back there, and it's a river that has many memories for her, memories of her childhood, of her parents. So that was what this one is about. And it's not 575. Now, this one by Santoka, who's also a well-respected Japanese haiku poet, also known for writing haiku that are not 575 necessarily. This one is only 13 sounds, and it has no season word. And yet for most of it, it's kind of resonates. It's got the nature thing in it. 13 sounds. Here's one by Ippe Kiro, who was also one of the early people to start experimenting with haiku that are not 17 sounds, that do not necessarily have season words. This one has a season word, the Asian pear. It is 24 sounds. He also wrote in a more colloquial style, so... Here's another Santoka one. Okay. 13 sounds. This one, 7 sounds. You'll notice that Mudo is the same person who did the Mitsumame haiku, the one with the picture with the jelly. And my point with that is that it's tempting to think, okay, there are haiku poets who are doing fixed form season word haiku, and there are some who are doing more non-fixed form, not season word. But many haiku poets in Japan are writing a mix of both. It depends on the poem. It depends on the situation. It depends on what moves them. So Mudo is a great example of someone who is really pretty well known for his non-fixed form haiku, and yet who also wrote some beautiful fixed form ones. Here we go with this one. He had TB, and so that kind of explains a little more, gives us a little more understanding of his poem, which was something that I found that I personally believe is important in haiku, that it's useful to understand or to know a little about the poet himself or herself, that if we didn't know that Hosai had TB, we would have less ability to understand the depth of this haiku. In my book, I Wait for the Moon, the commentary, I feel, are as important, and I worked probably as much on the commentary as I did on the translation of the haiku, because I wanted to give the readers enough understanding of Momoko and her life without giving you so much that I took away all of the pleasure and mystery of a haiku. So basically what we've seen here is that Japanese haiku is not always 5-7-5, and that has been the case for a long time. As we saw, Basho wrote haiku that were not necessarily 5-7-5. They do not always have a seasoned word. They can be on a variety of topics. They can be on issues related to war. They can be on remarking on the beauty of nature. They can be on sketches of life, as it's called. They could be objective sketches of life. One of the things that's fun that I found in Japanese haiku, the world of Japanese haiku, is I call them battles, but you know, there are these deep conversations and arguments about what should be a haiku. Is it the form? What should be inside a haiku? Should haiku be social consciousness haiku? Should haiku have an animist sentiment? Should haiku express something about nature? Should they be objective? Should they be lyrical? There is this big conversation going on. And it's something that I think is important for those of us who are writing haiku in the West to really better understand. There's a tendency in American haiku, especially by people who are just learning about haiku or have learned haiku in elementary school, which is to just count up the syllables, and as soon as you've got 17, you've got a haiku. Before I move on to looking at English language haiku, I wanted to do one more thing, which is, so basically I'm going back to this one, and the question is, so now that we know that there's a whole range of kinds of haiku, is this one a haiku or not? There's someone named Hiroaki Sato who has expressed something that I agree with, which is my personal view, which is that if someone says to me, here's a haiku, I've written a haiku, it's not for me to say, that's not a haiku. I might think it's a very poor haiku. I might say it's not the kind of haiku that I want to be writing. But we have to respect the individual's intent. So if the person who wrote this for the municipality came up to me and said, yeah, I meant this to be as a haiku, I would say, that's nice. I don't know that I would agree. I wouldn't care for it as a haiku for a number of reasons, one of which is that for me, I don't like haiku to be telling me what I should think and feel. I want haiku to be an expression of something I've experienced or that I've felt. So it's a little bit pedantic for my taste. Okay, this is the one I just wanted to mention. And I can show later when we turn the lights on, but for now I think it's fine. We'll just keep it as that the form of haiku in Japan, most haiku collections, the haiku are all one straight line and maybe four or five to a page. But when they are being placed on a different format, in this case a rock, it's called a kuki, the artist might break it up differently. In this case, the first one, he has, I think, the first five sounds, and then the second line is the remaining 12. Frankly, because I think it kind of fit in the rock that way, and it does make a nice cut in the first one. In this one, again, Momoko, you know, she gives it this bent and cuts it in three. As I said later, I can show you a visual after the lights go on to talk a little more about this. But the variety of, you know, again, in English, we often think, well, in fact, there are these discussions. Should a haiku be three lines? Should it be one line? Should it be four lines? And there, too, I think a little variety in how we think about haiku. You know, sometimes the best way to look at it is that the form should be adapted to the expression rather than adapting the expression to the form. And even in my translations, most of the translations in my I Wait for the Moon, I translated as three lines because, frankly, most American readers are more familiar with that. And when you're introducing the haiku of a poet that many people may not have read before, I didn't want them to get all distracted by the form. And so I did it in a way that was aesthetically familiar. But there were exceptions. And this one I just translated in the book as one line for a couple of reasons. One is I tried to cut it up, but every time I cut it up, it would change the meaning of it. You know, if you look at it, okay, if the first line is as of flying toward me, then the second line would be comes, I guess, and the third line would be the autumn pilgrim, and it just looked odd. I couldn't do it in three ways and do justice to the poem. And the second reason I did it as one line is that it gives a sense of speed. You know, we picture that this pilgrim, she was in Shikoku on the Shikoku Henro pilgrimage, and turning a corner, and suddenly she sees a pilgrim coming around the corner at a fast clip. So one line kind of gave it a sense of speed. So now with that as a background, I want to look a little bit at English language haiku. And here what I'm really going to do is just put some up on the screen and we could look at them and savor them a bit. There are thousands of superb haiku being written in English, probably tens of thousands. I just picked some that I personally liked, and I hope will give you a sense of the variety of haiku that are being written in English today. Arlene Mountain writes very often one-line haiku. She has some amazing haiku. This is probably one of her more quote-unquote tame haiku. We'll see another one of hers later. Jim Cation created the Haiku Foundation, which is an online resource. If you Google it, you will see there's something called the Haiku Registry, a range of haiku poems by a range of American authors, or English language authors, I apologize. Now, this one is 575, so my point is that that I'm not saying that a poem in English should not be 575, but it doesn't have to be. That's not in Japan, certainly that's not how a poem is defined. Poems that are not 575 are not thrown out. And so too in English. This one is 575. What I find really moving about it is that the word angry, for me, makes the poem. And it makes it both because it gives richness and intensity to the poem, but also because when we look at the author, and knowing a little bit about the author's background and what his life stood for and the kind of writing he did, it adds another level of poignancy that the owls are angry in his poems. He wrote this one toward the end of his life. He was in France. He only had about 18 months left to live. He was sick. He didn't know he had 18 months. But this is quite a beautiful poem for me. Christopher Harold lives in Washington State. I like the play on the word sound, which is also a technique that is common in Japanese, that a word can have several meanings. I also like the we, that a haiku is not just necessarily about my personal experience. It's perfectly okay to write a haiku that is a shared collective concept. Maggie Chula lives in Portland, I think, Oregon? Maybe not Portland, okay. When I told her I was choosing this one, I didn't tell everyone texted her and I said, oh, I'm going to use this one. And she said, oh, no, I don't want to be known as the outhouse haiku poet. So I offered to throw in another one. But this one is wonderful. It also uses a technique that's very common in a well-known technique in Japanese haiku as well, where you make this contrast between the near and the far. I also like the contrast between the humble act that the human being is doing and the grandeur of nature. That's great. So please read her other haiku so she's not just the outhouse haiku poet. This one I wrote, I just threw this one in because this one has no nature in it. It just has, you know, actually I wrote this, it was me and my husband early on in our marriage. You know, when I wrote it, I just wrote it, as many of us who write haiku do. It wasn't until later that I start analyzing it or I look at other people. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me now when I look at it is that we have two human beings who have to step over inanimate objects to connect with each other. When I wrote it, I didn't say, okay, now I'm going to try to capture that sentiment and convey it in words. You know, I just wrote the thing. Majdanek, Sobibor, and Belzec are sites of concentration camps in Poland. Kind of speaks for itself. This is another Marlene Mountain one that I just wanted to show, this sort of a, I wouldn't call it political haiku, but it's this is a feeling that she expressed in haiku form. She has some really good feminist haiku as well. This one is, I have this one, it's the last haiku I will show. The reason I choose this one, or I mention this one, is because this is the one that was selected as first prize last year's International Mainichi Haiku Contest. And the interesting thing is that the judge is a Japanese person, and this haiku has no season word. Rooster is not a season word. It's not 575. And the interesting thing was the selector was Toru Haga, who had this to say about the haiku. Quote, Western haiku, free from the strictures of kigo, that's season words, can write haiku based upon their own experience and seek to comprehend a modern world such as this, in which the crow of the rooster alone is lively while the earth continues to revolve with its gloom. I wrote that haiku when I was doing some work for the Asia Foundation in East Timor, and I had arrived, and the day it was, turned out it was a holiday, and so the office was closed. There was nothing to do, so I just walked all over the island. I walked all over the place and was really moved by the poverty of the island and the really difficult life that many people had there. I got back to my room, and I couldn't sleep. I'm not a great sleeper anyway, but I was just thinking about this, and I was a little jet-lagged and, you know, feeling a little dizzy. I was sort of up all night thinking about this inequality in the world, and, you know, then the rooster's cry comes through, and that was the haiku. I'm going to leave you all to answer that one later. And lastly, I want to mention this back to Japan thing. So why did Toruhaga think it important for English language haiku to be, or to draw attention to English language haiku that are not meeting any of the traditional form of Japanese form? And his sense is that maybe in the West we are able to do things with haiku now that could be done more in Japan. My personal view is that now there are more people who are writing haiku outside of Japan in this world than there are writing haiku in Japan. Because we did not come from a heritage of a natural fixed form for haiku, most people in the West are writing what the Japanese would call a free-form haiku without season words. In Japan, people are writing free-form haiku, but it's a minority. More people are writing fixed-form haiku. My thesis is that bringing some of these Western haiku back to Japan opens up the possibility for Japanese haiku poets to look at the range of things that can be done with free-form haiku. So that's it, and I'm happy to answer questions. Yes?
I wanted to, could you remind me what the three things were? There's the season word.
The 17 sounds, season word, okay. And a cut word.
Okay, a cut word. So 17 sounds. I don't remember them.
Well, it's good that you don't remember them, because the whole point is that now, having said that, many people write excellent traditional haiku. In fact, we have members of the Yuki Teike Haiku Society, which is founded on the concept of writing fixed form haiku, and there are some wonderful poets writing with that group, but and other people I know sometimes start with a 575 and then look at their haiku and say, well, maybe it would actually be better if I didn't have the word the here. It's unnecessary. So there's a whole range of ways of going about coming up with a haiku. But my basic point is that it's what we try to do with haiku. It's what we're trying to express with haiku that is important.
Yeah. That's cool.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Was haiku an indigenous Japanese form or come out of an earlier Japanese form or possibly a Chinese influence?
It's an indigenous form. It came out of a linked verse form. When Basho, why is he's considered the father of Japanese haiku is basically he's the one who popularized this idea of taking the first stanza of a linked verse form and basically having that stand alone. It was called the hokku at the time, and Shiki came along in the 19th century and renamed it the haiku. I mean, other people were using the word haiku, but he really popularized it as being renamed the haiku. The issue of Chinese influence is interesting because a lot of the haiku in Basho's day and a lot of his haiku they connect back to Chinese poetry often because the literary heritage within which he was writing was heavily influenced by China and Chinese poets. So a lot of his haiku might indirectly be a play on or a turning of a Li Po poem, for example. Yes.
It's just my understanding that Japanese use a few types of ABC, and one of them is composed of Chinese characters, and I guess two more is more modernized. It's just a wonder which ABC is used to write haiku.
It's fun for me to do this because we have Japanese people in the audience, and so they must be wondering, this is pretty interesting to hear an American woman explain their language to them. So correct me if I do it incorrectly, but there are, as you correctly said, there are three different forms. They have the Chinese characters, kanji, there is hiragana, and there is katakana. And all three of them are found in haiku, and a haiku poet in Japan will often make a choice about which of these to use, depending on what message they want to use. Momoko has a haiku, so she has 6,000 haiku, and I only picked 100. So I had to figure out which ones to use. But one of them that I did not use, she had the word haiku in it, written in English. I don't remember what the poem was, but that's another kind of cool thing that... but she actually had it with I guess it's Romaji, right? Yeah, the Romaji, yeah. So she had that thrown in. But it's a mix.
When I was on sabbatical in Japan, I was studying Japanese haiku, and I noticed that among those that were traditional haiku, Basho, Basan, Busan, mm-hmm. and so on, Ishike, that many of them were much shorter than our haiku that we were writing with the Yukiteki Haiku Society, mm-hmm. which were 5, 7, 5. Mm-hmm. And we ended up shortening many of our haiku because there were a lot of superfluous words in them. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that most of the traditional ones were about 10, 11, or 12 words, if you want to call them words.
When you translate
when
them.
You take them from the Japanese uh-huh. traditionalists. Uh-huh. And it seems like in American haiku, if we're going to identify with the Japanese haiku, they need to be shorter because the anji is much shorter than the syllable. I mean, Kyoto is 4 syllables in Japan. 4 anji.
Well, this is the whole challenge for me with the syllable thing.
So I wonder what you thought about that. Because when I came back, I no longer maintained my membership in the Yukiteki Haiku Society because they were still writing 5, 7, 5. But they've changed mm-hmm. since then.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's good to know. I think that when I translated Momoko's haiku... very few people who are translating haiku will try to translate it into a 17-syllable form. And those that do, frankly, I don't think do it very well, succeed. I never really thought about syllables. I did think about where to put the cuts, whether to make it one line. I have one of the haiku I translated is 4 lines. It just worked that way. Interestingly, I did a lot of French language haiku as well. I lived in Quebec. I'd lived in France as a child. And I noticed that a lot of native French speakers' haiku tend to be wordier than we would make it in English. And so when I was running this haiku group, English and French, my first instinct was, oh, well, these are too long. But then I thought, no, in their language, that's a natural pattern. It is their haiku were wordier, and it was comfortable. It was natural for them. So I did not get into the business of trying to adjust how people wrote their haiku in another language.
I have a slightly more mundane question. You mentioned that there's an encyclopedia, and for a word to be considered a seasonal word, it must be included in the encyclopedia. So I was curious about how a word finds its way into that document.
That's a great question. I think compendia is probably the better word, because an encyclopedia suggests that, like the Encyclopedia Britannica, there's some editor who decides. They tend to be a group of haiku poets who are sufficiently established that they have some measure of authoritativeness, and they can actually get this published and do that. There's something that is culturally very different between Japan and the U.S., and which plays into this, because in Japan you have haiku masters. You have there's a sense of structure. So you have haiku masters. You have people who can authoritatively write a haiku compendia and would be respected for it, and other people would not really be sufficiently established to do that. They do disagree sometimes. So you will have some of the people who favor contemporary free-form haiku have put together a compendium that maybe has some haiku that are some season words that may not be necessarily in a season word compendium that was done 50 years earlier. One of the things that's interesting with this point is that that I often see that Japanese haiku is a form that is trying to break free of its past structures, whereas English language haiku is all over the place and people are trying to fit it into a structure. And maybe that's why people are so obsessed with 575, because it's scary. It's like riding a bicycle without training wheels the first time you get on the bike. So there is no Académie Française of Japanese haiku. Yes.
You may have discussed this earlier. I'm afraid I got late. I went to Market Street and not here. But in any event, is there something about the Japanese language that makes 575 a more comfortable form? You were saying in Quebec they have a different style, and it's related to their own patterns of speech. So is that the case in Japan?
Momoko would say that, because one time I asked her, I said, well, so how should haiku in English be? Should I make it three lines or should you? And she looked at me and she said, like, well, how would I know? You know, I don't speak English. Do what's natural for your language. And her point was that 575 is a more natural form. And in fact, I think that's why that sympathy toward people, towards cars, whatever that was, you know, it's probably not a haiku. It's just in the natural form of 575. And when I was writing haiku in Japanese, I never really struggled to jam things into the 575 form. I struggled to come up with something that had meaning or that was beautiful, but somehow it was pretty easy to come up with that. So I think there is a natural form to it.
Then have you decided on the natural English form, at least for your own interpretation?
For me, I am still, it's still evolving. And I have a book, a collection of my own haiku coming out this fall. And I was really struck. I was struggling with that because I said, well, you know, it's inconsistent. I have some haiku that are a little long and then others that I think really should be one line. So so I don't have a – I guess I go back to, for me, the what I want to express. I start with the thing that I need to express, and then I figure out what form it should be. And that's that works best for me. I actually like one-line haiku a lot, and so one of the things that I'm struggling with is that I started out writing three-line haiku, and so if I shift to one-line haiku, do I have to put those in a different book, or what do I do with it? So it's a question I still grapple with.
It's not a question, you know, but rather a comment. And I've forgotten, you know, a precise term, but I guess in Japan, seasons, you know, have, and changing seasons, you know, have very special meaning, you know, which is much better developed, you know, than in English. And various associations and mental illusions. And my understanding, you know, when they use, you know, a season word, they, so to speak, you know, set the stage. So the Japanese reader immediately has, you know, this kind of like a set of associations, you know, with this word, which we may not have when we say, you know, a spring or chirping, you know, a bird or something. Do I make sense?
Yeah, and one of the so some of the. For example, there's a term, and I don't remember, koromigae. I'm trying to think of what the changing of the clothes is, a specific seasonal term. It was kind of hard to use a haiku of Momoko's and translate that and put it in the book because I'd spend my entire time explaining what that changing of the clothes evoked. In other cases, I did, I didn't want to steer completely away. So there are, and especially because Momoko's haiku, she's all about being Japanese. It's really interesting. You know, she's well known for her pilgrimages to all of these historic sites, pilgrimages to cherry blossoms. So of course, most of the haiku I translate have some connection to something Japanese that a Japanese person would read, and as you said, immediately evokes all kinds of things. But, you know, once you start, once you say you're going to translate someone's haiku, there's no backing down. So,
your presentation included three questions that you have mulled over time, and I'm sure forms the basis of the discussion today. But I'm wondering if you could just directly answer the third question and tell us what the essence of haiku is to you.
Yes, actually. I've got that written down. The reason I'm looking this up is because I have thought about that a lot, and I had written down what three different people. Well, okay. I'm going to give you a few of these. One was R.H. Blythe, who many of you may have known, have heard of. He is one of the early translators of Japanese haiku, did a four-volume set, just incredible, and wrote many, many books on Japanese haiku. He said, quote, "A haiku shows us what we knew all the time but did not know we knew. It shows us that we are poets insofar as we live at all." Kaneko Tota, who is a contemporary haiku master, believes, his views have evolved, but he believes that haiku should reflect animism, or the idea that human beings are not separate from but a part of all living things. Momoko has said that a haiku is a reflection of one's soul, and each person's soul is different, and so each haiku is going to be different. For me, I see a haiku as capturing a truth, an artistic truth unique to each individual. that for some reason has bubbled up into our consciousness and insists of, in being brought to life through words. So that's, you know, these are different things that I would call the essence of haiku. Momoko's advice to me was always, don't try to write a haiku that's like Isa or that's like Basho's haiku. Write a haiku that is true to you. And if you can write a haiku that reflects you, then you're writing a good haiku. Thank you.
Speaking of that, I write quote unquote haiku when I'm traveling.
Uh-huh.
Because it's economical. Instead of writing all of these things, I did this and I did that. But my question was, if only I read it and it recalls what my experience was, does that meet your, standard for a haiku?
Well, so what I do is, for example, in putting together a collection of my own haiku, I don't put in the haiku that have great meaning for me, but that aren't really going to have meaning for someone else. I love those haiku. They have huge meaning for me. I can look at one of those haiku, and it evokes, it's better than a photograph or a mm-hmm. postcard. So those are valuable for me, and I keep them. But when I'm putting together something that I want to publish, then I don't always select those. Although, and again, these are things that I grapple with all the time. In this collection I'm putting together of my own haiku, I have two haiku in there that are clearly have meaning for me. But I thought, well, let's throw them in and see what happens. And I'm really curious. I want to know if someone, after that book gets published, what's going to happen? Are they going to say, this one doesn't work for me? Or maybe they'll see something. But I keep the ones that have meaning for me. Thank you.
And you had a scroll that you wanted to show off. So I was going to show this, but I didn't want to go with the lights on or off. Well, when I showed that there are different ways of writing, you know, whether it's three lines, one line. There was the haiku about the river of Ayu returning, river of my father, river of my mother. The first line in that one is seven sounds, and then five sounds, and then five sounds, seven, five, five. When she, Momoko had a scroll made, of that haiku. So the scroll has the 5-7-5. It has river of my father, river of Ayu returning, river of my mother. When she gave it to me, she said, you know it's read this way. Right. And I said, oh, okay. And I thought to myself, if I had not known that poem, how would I know that? And I don't think she really cared. the point for me is that there is an aesthetic sense that she's right. It would have been really lopsided to write it out the way she wrote. When she published the haiku in her book, right, it's a printed thing, it was all one line. But when she was putting it on a scroll, it just is more beautiful this way. It's balanced. The cool thing is that when I gave this talk Saturday at the Asian Art Museum, an audience like yours, and so I show this, and a Japanese woman was in the audience, and she said, oh, yeah, and now there's the balance between the father and the mother. And I thought, oh, that's interesting.
Father's a little bit higher.
So you know, haiku. It's interesting because haiku is there's a playfulness to haiku. There is a fun to haiku, and one of the fun things for me, I'm a pretty serious person, but one of the fun things for me is how people. I'm constantly learning from people's reactions. I only know a small sliver of things, so that was it.
Would you join me in thanking Abigail Friedman? Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And our thanks again to the Japan Society of Northern California and the Japanese Consulate here in San Francisco. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is now adjourned.